One of my colleagues may have shared this quotation from the Buddha. It's a famous quotation, one line, where he once said, "Now and before, I teach one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering." Maybe it was me who shared that. Maybe it was another retreat. I don't know. "Now and before, I teach only one thing, suffering and the end of suffering." This is a statement can be seen as a kind of condensed version of the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, which is at the core, the heart of what we're doing here, the heart of everything the Buddha taught. In my view, anything any of us might say, anything the Buddha ever said in all of the many discourses he gave, everything was pointing back to this core teaching. Unfortunately, historically, a lot of people stopped at the "I teach suffering" part. And it's given Buddhism a bad rap, like a downer religion. Life is suffering. Good luck with that. Have a nice day. But the Buddha didn't stop there. He said, "I teach the end of suffering, suffering and the end of suffering." And the Buddha and his followers, at that time, they were known as the happy ones. He and his followers were known to be happy. They weren't hanging around all bummed out, "Oh, life's a suffering." Too bad. They were famous for their contentment, peaceful demeanor, for being happy. And I think it's important for us to remind ourselves that this is a path of joy. It's leading in the direction of ease, peace, freedom, contentment, joy, the deepest kind of joy. This quality of contentment is pretty elusive, I think, for many of us. Certainly in our culture it is. We live in a culture of discontent in so many ways, and we always seem to be in a state of lack. So much we seem to need, and there's this whole humongous industry of advertising that's based on persuading us that you need this. All these things we need. And they are beautiful sometimes, or at least the people who are enjoying them are beautiful. And if we had that thing, we'd be beautiful too. And so we look for contentment outside ourselves in so many ways, in things and experiences. And we see our ability to realize anything like contentment as dependent on external conditions. We lose sight of the fact that the contentment is an internal thing. And we lose, there's a great loss of personal power when we are focused in this way on external things. I remember I first came here in 1992, I believe, to IMS, and I had been to one retreat before I came out here in California, and I heard about this place. I'd never heard of IMS before, and one of the teachers there, who's a dear friend and colleague of mine, one of my first teachers, talked about that there was a 3-month retreat and I wanted to do that, and the conditions in my life were such that I was leaving a situation with work and where I was living where I didn't have to stay in that life and I could come out here. And I didn't qualify to sit the 3-month retreat, so I had to sit another retreat before I could apply. So I came out in the summer and stayed and was here kind of sort of work retreat, temporary staff for part of the summer, and then I went on retreat at the 3-month retreat in that fall. So it was my third retreat ever, and I had been meditating for about 5 or 6 months prior to that. And so I was relatively new to practice, you could say. And I remember one time I was sitting somewhere, maybe in the dining room. It was a little, it's much nicer now than it was in some ways. Bigger for sure. And I was just sitting there at one of the tables, and I remember feeling a kind of contentment that I don't think I'd ever experienced before. And it wasn't because I was having a great time. I was just happy. I remember thinking to myself that there were two things that struck me. I loved being able to live carefully the way that I was living on retreat, with mindfulness, trying to be mindful all the time, not succeeding, but that was my intention. And I loved living that carefully. And I also remember feeling this quality of contentment that I had never experienced before. In these very simple conditions, having days like yours. And it was very striking to me that the contentment was clearly my internal experience and did not have to do with what was going on around me. Last year I had a chance to do 6 weeks of my own retreat, personal retreat time, and there was one of the apartments that the teachers stay in when we're here teaching was available for me to use for that retreat. And I came, and I was having a lot of, I have some back issues, and they were really flaring up at that time. And I was also having very bad headaches, 3 or 4 or 5 times a week, the kind that have you curled up on the floor, hoping you survive, wanting someone to put you out of your misery. Pretty bad headaches. Some of you might have experience with very strong headaches of this kind. And so I had some challenges in this way, in the bodily life especially perhaps. But again, I was happy and contented. I didn't want anything I didn't have. I didn't crave for things to be different. When I was in pain, then I was in pain. And when I wasn't. And it was all part of my life. And again, struck by this quality of contentment that was there. And it was independent of the conditions that I was, in many ways at least, independent of that. So back to this statement, now and before I teach only one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. The end of suffering sounds pretty good. I think we'd all be down for that. But why teach suffering? What does that mean? What might the Buddha have meant? How would that lead to happiness? And I think part of the problem here is that there's a word in Pali, which many of you know, dukkha, we've used it here, which is translated often as suffering. But that's not a great translation. The teacher, Tanissaro Bhikkhu, he's a monk, he goes by Tan Jeff also, he said this, "No single English word adequately captures the full depth, range, and subtlety of the crucial Pali term dukkha. Many translations of the word have been used, stress, he likes that, unsatisfactoriness, suffering, and so forth. And each has its own merits in a given context. There is value in not letting oneself get too comfortable with any one particular translation of the word, since the entire thrust of Buddhist practice is the broadening and deepening of one's understanding of dukkha until its roots are finally exposed and eradicated once and for all." That's a strong statement. The entire thrust of the Buddhist practice is the broadening and deepening of one's understanding of dukkha. So it's worth investigating what this means, what it's pointing to, why the Buddha said, "I teach this." So we can understand it on different levels. The most kind of fundamental level, it does refer to suffering on a certain level, pain and painful feelings that are associated with having a body, with birth and aging, sickness and death, and all that comes with having one of these things to go around in, and all the difficult mental and emotional states that often accompany these painful feelings or arise at times for all of us. We all have difficult mind states and emotions that are hard to be with. And these can be said to a way of looking at what dukkha is. On a more subtle level, dukkha points to qualities of unreliability or kind of insecurity. And there are, in this way, they are intrinsic to all of our experience, all the experiences that arise for us in life, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant. So we don't usually think of suffering in relation to pleasant feelings in the body, pleasant mind states. But on this level, dukkha is a kind of unsatisfactoriness or fragility that is a characteristic of all experience, produced directly related to produced by the change, the fact that things change. So pleasant experiences don't last; they're not reliable in this way. So the most sublime experience we might have, the time when we feel just the most exalted, perhaps, uplifted, it has this quality of dukkha in that it is not going to last, and so it cannot be a reliable source for lasting happiness. Does this make sense? I'm talking about this. It's not that there's something wrong with it. It's pleasant and beautiful, and I wish you to have all of these, as many of these as possible, beautiful, exalted, sublime experiences. May they come for you. But they're not reliable in the long term because they don't last. They're subject to change. So there's a basic fragility, unsatisfactoriness that pervades all of life, directly related to the fact that things are in a state of constant flux and change. Everything is impermanent and largely outside of our direct control. And we talk about this so much. Martha, my colleagues have spoken about this. Things are arising out of conditions. We're not in control of it. Before I came to IMS, at that time, I was living in San Francisco. I lived there for a little over 10 years, during most of the 80s and into the early 90s. And I had a good life there. I had interesting work and really good friends and colleagues. I had a really great place to live. I lived in an old converted fire station. Very cool. And I had achieved a level of coolness unprecedented. There has been a tragic decline over the years since then. But at that time, vintage BMW motorcycle, R50/2, for those of you who know, living in the fire station, bohemian artist, urban artist life. And I had, you know, gotten my act together and on a certain level, you know, I was living a good life. Wasn't rich, but I was happy living that life. And yet there was this thread of discontentment and dissatisfaction. I felt like I'd done everything to get my life the way it was supposed to be, and yet there was always this, well, is this all? Kind of a question, this feeling of dissatisfaction running through my days. And I wasn't bummed out. Things were good. But I was touching into one aspect of dukkha there in this, this vulnerability, this thread of dis-ease running through my days. And really, actually opening to this was the main impetus and motivation behind my deciding to go to a meditation retreat. Look for something else. Maybe some version of this kind of motivation got you to come to this retreat. Some feeling of dissatisfaction or discontent, even though maybe circumstances in your life were pretty good. So as we start to touch into both the depth and breadth of this kind of insecurity, this vulnerability, this fragility that's woven into the fabric of what we might call the human condition, we see the size of that cloth, the universality of our situation. And this is really the beginning of opening to the truth of dukkha, which is the first of the Four Noble Truths. This is from translator, teacher, Bhikkhu Bodhi. Whether in the form of pain, frustration, or distress, suffering reveals the basic insecurity of the human condition. It throws before our awareness, in a way we cannot evade, the vast gulf stretching between our ingrained expectations and the possibilities for their fulfillment in a world never fully susceptible to domination by our will. This vast gulf between our expectations that we should be able to have it be a certain way and the likelihood that that will occur or last very long, because the world is not fully susceptible to domination by our will. I like the way he puts it. You know, as both my colleagues have said, you know, we have this conditioning to think that we should be able to get our lives to the point where things are always the way we want them to be. Always pleasant, as if somehow we should be exempt from the truth of change. That we should have that kind of control. There are these three characteristics that, and when we look, we start to see they are an aspect of all of our experience. And we talk about these in different ways all the time. This truth of change, this truth of anicca is change, of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, vulnerability that I've been talking about, and anatta, corelessness or uncontrollability or impersonality or not self, literally. These are qualities that apply to all our experience. And in a way, you could say that we're looking for stability, reliability, and a sense of personal empowerment or agency. And those are good things. It's not wrong to want these things or to seek them. But we're looking at that which is unstable, unreliable, and out of our control. We're looking in the wrong place for those things. So this path and practice is reorienting us so that we start looking for stability, reliability, and a sense of personal empowerment or agency in a place where we might actually find those things. It's a radical shift of perception and orientation in life. Because when we fail to be able to get things the way they're supposed to be, and it's shaky, and they don't last, and they change, and the good times fall away, or something, we get sick, or someone we love gets sick, or all the things that can come in a life. It leads us to take the truth of dukkha personally, as though somehow it's our fault, that we did something wrong. But it's not a personal problem. It impacts all beings who take birth and live. It's an ailment that is embedded in the very fabric of our existence, affects all of us, all beings, and it informs our lives constantly and profoundly. This fragility, this kind of vulnerability, unreliability of conditioned experience, of things that arise and pass away. And so a meaningful understanding of this truth and a wise relationship to it is really crucial as we walk this path and explore these teachings. Because the Buddha's liberation is not about escaping from life and all the changes and the ups and downs and the joys and sorrows. Life goes on. But suffering in relation to that is another matter entirely. And this is where we have some ability to negotiate. This is where practice happens, is in how we relate to lives, the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows that come for all of us, and life's changing, unpredictable nature. So it is this radical reorientation that points us to look for happiness, stability, reliability, a sense of personal agency and empowerment in a place where we might actually find them. And so in exploring the human condition, the Buddha came to a key understanding. He saw that stress, struggle, suffering in relation to this pervasive unsatisfactoriness, unreliability, fragility of experience are born in the mind and arise out of how we're relating to experience, as I've been saying. Now, this is not to deny the very real suffering that comes for many in life. Many people, many beings, racism, poverty, injustice, oppression. These are very real and not to be somehow glossed over or denied. And the simple truth is that sometimes life is hard. We do get sick. Those we love get sick. We lose our job. Things happen. Sometimes life is hard. This path, it's not about getting rid of painful feelings in the body and mind in difficult times. The Buddha had chronic back pain, bad days, he had to deal with people he would probably really have wished he could avoid. He had a cousin who was jealous, who tried to kill him on numerous occasions. People trying to give him a bad reputation, spreading rumors about him. And he had a lot of, things that weren't so great. But there was not suffering in relation to those things. That's the difference there. The Buddha got old, got sick, and died. And if we look, we'll see that the root of much, if not most, of our struggle, stress in life has its genesis in our mind and results from our resistance and denial of the truth of change, our usually futile attempts to control conditions and keep them a certain way. But this understanding runs really counter to our conditioning and the way we usually look at things, because we're very, very conditioned to look outside of ourselves, both for the source of our stress and struggles and for the solution to them. But this understanding that it is an internal thing is such good news, because if our suffering were entirely due to external conditions, the situation would ultimately be hopeless, because we aren't in control of that. Is this making sense? The Buddha saw that we have a misunderstanding about where to look for happiness, what brings happiness. But he saw that we can undo this misunderstanding. We can learn a new way of relating to life, to experience, to meet the conditions, the changing, unpredictable conditions, from a place of ease and balance of mind and heart. And we can find freedoms right in the midst of that life of unpredictability and change. This is from the Thai forest master monk Ajahn Chah, famous teacher. There are two kinds of suffering: the suffering that leads to more suffering and the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. If you are not willing to face the second kind of suffering, you will surely continue to experience the first. So until we actually open to the truth of dukkha, we'll be looking for a way out of it, always turning to that which by its very nature is inherently unreliable, ultimately incapable of bringing us the lasting happiness that we seek. And it's an endless, ultimately futile search. And we just keep at it till we run out of time and energy. So skillfully opening to the truth of dukkha will lead us to seek a reliable path, one that might lead in the direction we want to go. This is the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. So when the Buddha said, "Now and before I teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering," actually two things. He was pointing, you know, we have to really see what's going on here. We realize the end of suffering by understanding its nature, actually seeing it, understanding its cause, releasing that very cause. So these are the Four Noble Truths: the noble truth of suffering, dukkha, the noble truth of the cause of it, the noble truth of the cessation of it, and the path leading to the cessation of suffering, the Noble Eightfold Path. We realize the end of suffering by understanding its nature and abandoning its very cause. And this lets us let go of a lot of stress and struggle in our life. We stop fighting against the way things are and come into alignment and harmony with the truth of the way things are. And through this kind of shift in view and strategy, we start to touch the possibility of a deep kind of happiness, a kind of contentment, you could say, or peace, a freedom of mind and heart that is, to a great extent, if not completely, independent of the changing conditions that we encounter. Good day, I'm okay. Bad day, I'm okay. And the key that unlocks the door to this kind of freedom is mindfulness. This simple ability we have to be present in each moment. Check it out right now. Feel the body sitting. Feel the mind, the quality of the mind and heart. It's right there anytime we look. And it's a complete game changer. With mindfulness, everything is possible. Without it, nothing is possible. We're just living out our conditioning. This is the rolling on of samsara. Beings rolling on in search of happiness and doing the very things that lead to more suffering. The Buddha often used simple images to illustrate points he was trying to make. And there's one that I want to share. It's a very famous one. It's the image of a raft which is being used to cross a flooded area. Roxanne referred to the practice in terms of this crossing a flood in her talk yesterday. These are the words of the Buddha. "Suppose someone were traveling along a path and saw a great expanse of water with the near shore dubious and risky, and the further shore secure and free from risk, but with neither a ferry boat nor a bridge going from this shore to the other. The thought would occur to them, here is this great expanse of water with the near shore dubious and risky, the further shore secure and free from risk, but with neither a ferry boat nor a bridge going from this shore to the other. What if I were to gather together grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and having bound them together to make a raft, were to cross over to safety to the other shore, in dependence on the raft, and by making an effort with my hands and feet? And then, having gathered together grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and having bound them together to make a raft, they would cross over to safety to the other shore, in dependence on the raft, and by making an effort with their hands and feet. A very typical way the teachings are presented, in a lot of repetition in these images. I think it's a great image, very useful, because often that which motivates us to seek a path and practice, what we might call a spiritual life, to come to a retreat like this, is a sense of being swept along by events in life, by a flood of worries and responsibilities and obligations and duties and all of life's changes and worries and pressures. Flood of change and unpredictability and all that comes in life. And so crossing this flood is this image of crossing from this place of insecurity to a place of stability and ease. It's like finding what we might think of as a true refuge. We use the word refuge a lot in this practice. And we need to not hold this kind of image too literally, because it's not that we go somewhere other than where we are or get something or some place different than this. We end up where we started, but our understanding changes. We use our raft to cross the flood of confusion and ignorance and delusion to the far shore and the secure ground of wisdom, understanding, and peace. I like this image of the raft because there are some essential considerations. In this image from the Buddha, you might notice that the raft is not made out of special stuff. It's not like one went to the special sawmill and got just really nice teak boards and planed them down and spent a year putting together a beautiful boat. It's a raft made out of twigs, leaves, and branches. We don't need special materials to make our raft. We use things that are nearby. So in actual practice, our raft is made out of the material of our moment-to-moment experience. It's made out of bodily sensations, feelings, thoughts, mind states. It's made out of restlessness and sleepiness. It's made out of doubt, made out of joy, happiness, bliss, sorrow. It's made from beautiful things and not beautiful things. It's made from things we like and things we don't like. It's all that comes in any mind moment is suitable material. So the very vehicle for liberation is this mundane stuff of just daily life, pleasant or unpleasant, gross or subtle, coarse or refined. It's all good. And it's a raft. It's not a luxury liner. It's not a really cool yacht. It's a funky raft. It's in the water. We're pushing it with our hands and feet, and we're probably going to get wet crossing the flood. When I was a kid, I lived in Phoenix, Arizona, very different place now, this 60 years later. It's changed so much. And the house I grew up in was near a big irrigation canal. And we, as kids, treated it like a river. And in those days, it had dirt sides and some plants and things, trees and reeds growing along it in places. And we used to build a raft. And we used sticks and old plastic jugs and pieces of styrofoam and things people were throwing away. And it was like branches, twigs, leaves, and grass. We would make these rafts and, you know, there was no way. In fact, the point was, because it's really hot there in the summer. We do this in the summer when we were off school. It's hot, like really hot. And so getting wet was the whole point of building the raft and getting in the canal. And then, of course, we weren't supposed to do it. Get in trouble. But we just used the junk that was laying around. So we gather up the stuff of our ongoing experience, whatever it is, and we bind it together with mindfulness. That's the rope and string that we use to hold our raft together. And the steadier and more continuous our mindfulness is, the more stable our raft will be. But sometimes it falls apart. In fact, probably fell apart once or twice today already. How many times did your raft fall apart today? Mine falls apart regularly when I'm on retreat. Or it gets broken up by the power of the flood, and we have to gather it back together and make a new raft out of what's floating by. But there's always something there. There's always a sensation, a sound, a feeling, a mood, an emotion, a thought. There's never a lack of material to make a raft. We can put it back together in any moment. So in meditation, we combine this quality of present moment, mindful awareness, and we weave it, we infuse it with kindness, acceptance, friendliness. And this begins to support and enable us to cultivate and touch into a certain stability of mind, balance of mind. And a kind of wise discernment arises just out of our willingness to be with our experience moment to moment. And we see directly for ourselves what leads in the direction of happiness, peace, freedom, what leads in the direction of suffering, in our own lives, in the world. We see what is worth cultivating and what we should abandon, what might actually serve us in our search for happiness. We start to see directly just through our willingness to show up and be with life. And this supports us in making wise choices in which kinds of energies we want to cultivate and follow. Wisdom and love and related friends. And which ones we want to let go of. And we reorient our relationship to this inherent unreliability, this dukkha, on the level of this fragility produced by constant change. We let go of struggling with that. We no longer relate to it as a mistake or as our fault, as our personal problem. We simply stop asking the world of changing conditions and unpredictability to provide us with something it can never provide. We stop looking there for the stability, reliability, and sense of personal empowerment that we're seeking. We don't look there for refuge. We don't have to take the truth of dukkha personally. We don't look at these things for refuge. We take refuge in wakefulness, in clear seeing, and in the truth of the way things are in any moment. That's our refuge. When we go for refuge, to Buddha. The word Buddha is the same root of the word for wakefulness. Dhamma, reality, nature, the way it is. Sangha, our potential to realize. And the community of those who are like-minded. These are reliable places to look for refuge. This is opening to the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. This transforms the truth of dukkha into a noble truth. We take our stand on reality, and we start to discover a kind of refuge that's available and reliable in any condition, no matter the circumstances. No matter what's happening. And if we're lucky enough to find this kind of refuge, this is a blessing, the greatest possible blessing we could have in life. And it's a blessing that's available in any moment. It's a real place of refuge. It's an inner refuge, and it goes with us everywhere, like a shadow or a dear friend. I want to share another poem. This is another interpretation of one of the poems of the early nuns by our friend Matti Weingast. This one is by a nun named Bhadra, which means lucky. Very short poem. You always considered yourself lucky because things seemed to work out the way you wanted. Now luck has a different meaning. Lucky to be walking a path that finds peace in the arising and passing away of each present moment, regardless of how things work out or don't. So let's have a moment of sitting together quietly. Thank you for your kind attention, and in a very short time from now, there will be a bell signaling the time for an evening meal, if you're interested in that, and then everything else that happens will follow on. So enjoy supper if you're eating it. Enjoy this beautiful late afternoon, and we'll see you around the place.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.